morning. Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also now podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the program at any time of day, ladies and gentlemen. And this site is made possible by DotFoil Computer Services right here in Santa Fe on the web at dotfoil.com. Now, later in the program, we're going to be talking to some folks from the Step It Up campaign and also about Mayor Koss's Generosity Sunday right here in Santa Fe. At this moment, I would like to welcome Scott Harrison, who is the director of the upcoming production Night Mother, and actors Lois Viscoli and Mona Malik. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi.
I almost said Marsha Norman, who is the playwright of this play, Night Mother, of which I saw the rehearsal last night, and it's a stunning and very intense play. The premise is that a mother and daughter who are living together, played by Lois Viscoli and Mona Malik, are having a nice evening at home, and right at the beginning of the play, the daughter announces that she's going to shoot herself. And things unfold from there, and life stories unfold from there. You, Scott Harrison, have done Sam Shepard plays in the past. How did you choose this play? I think of you as having done Sam Shepard plays for the last
like
500 years.
Yeah.
But it's only the last 2 years. But this has a sort of similar intensity.
Yeah, Mona and Lois had been interested. I think I had heard that Mona and Lois really liked the play, and we had talked about possibly doing a reading of it a couple years ago because we didn't really have the resources to build a whole kitchen set with where we were with the company. They both wisely wanted to see if we could do a full production of it, if we were actually going to work on it. And so last year we got, with True West, we were at a point where we'd built a kitchen set and we had all the stuff infrastructure-wise that we needed, and so we went ahead and went forward.
But it definitely recycled some of the set.
Yeah. So there'll be a contest. People that, whoever recognizes the most stuff from our past shows gets a free ticket.
Now, Lois and Mona, had either of you seen this play in a production someplace else?
Yes, I did, actually. I saw it on Broadway with Kathy Bates, and it was truly a remarkable experience. I remember being so moved by it. So I never thought at the moment that I'd be doing it. It was some time ago, but it was truly a riveting experience to watch it.
And it is a riveting experience, and it's very weird because the daughter who says at the beginning that she's about to shoot herself spends a lot of the play as if she were about to go on vacation or something, saying, "Now, be sure to buy the strong, hefty bags." And this household trivia is interspersed with deep family history and just existential stuff. Mm-hmm. How do you get into the spirit of playing that role? Especially the daughter's role is very, very deep.
Well, I mean, I did a lot of research about the subject, and it actually is a pretty common occurrence where people wrap up and actually pack things up and wrap things up and ship things out before they make this choice. And so it actually, as we worked on it, it became pretty logical, which was when I first read it and we first started working on it, it seemed so out there. And as we worked on it more and more, it just seemed so normal.
How long have the two of you been working on the play? Actually, the three of you been working on this play together.
How long, Scott?
We did a read through last April, I think. It's been about a year.
And so, a year is, I suppose, rather a long time to be working on material like this. And I would think it sort of sinks into a subconscious place where you've got more to draw on than if you've been rehearsing it for, say, 6 weeks.
Absolutely, and I think it is a play that really deals with the discovery a great deal, and we both, mother and daughter, discover a great deal about our lives and who we are, what our problems have been, and so forth. So it really encompasses a great deal of human emotion. It goes the full range, full gamut of of emotions, joy, anger, jealousy, a great deal. So it's a very deep play. It has a great deal to say. There's a lot of messages.
I was thinking about the different stages of grief that it said that people go through. And in a way, the mother character is acting out different stages of anger and acceptance and so on in advance of the suicide actually happens or not, right. But at the threat thereof.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I think, as I said before, a great deal is revealed. I mean, in a sense, the play is about my daughter's decision to do something, and the play, you know, and the mother, all the ways she can think of to stop her from doing it. And, of course, everything else comes up that's been important in their lives in that pursuit.
What were some of the things that you were thinking about while directing this play?
Well, one of the things is I think it's just a very, very well-told story. It's structured really well. It's got suspense. It's got a lot of humor. It's got a lot of surprises, twists and turns. And so in addition to dealing with the subject matter and the relationships between Mom and Jesse, I spent a lot of time just looking at storytelling, you know, and where there are moments of suspense, where it's there are sharp moments of contrast, where there are silences, and just trying to build that into the story, because I think you know, for the audience, it's a very gripping story, and the way it's written is very taut, and so it was a great challenge to just you know, look at the storytelling of the play.
There's a lot of very quick dialogue, and then there are some real silences that are very effective emotionally on the audience. Are those built in, or do you sort of choose where they go?
Yeah, there's some that are built in, and then some that we just found through. In a way, it's funny that the play seems to start off with a real quick rhythm, and there's a certain sense that their characters aren't really listening to each other, and it just snaps back and forth. And then as the play goes on, there's moments where they start hitting more core truths, and we found some space and some silences around those moments where a truth kind of lands in the middle of this struggle. So some of them were written in, and some of them we just found in rehearsal.
We're talking about the play Night Mother, which opens, let's see, help me out here, Scott, when does it open?
It's this Thursday, April 12th.
This Thursday, April 12th, yeah. And it runs for several weeks.
It runs for 3 weeks through the 29th of April.
And it's at El Museo Cultural.
Mm-hmm.
And actually sort of tucked away into it's not the main stage there, so to speak. It's sort of tucked away into a corner. You've actually made a theater stage out of nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, people that come in might wonder, you know, well, there's a full stage a few feet away. Why aren't you using that? But with True West last year, it worked really well with doing, and it works well for this type of play, too, a feeling where the audience is really right in it. You know, they're not able to be separated from it. So we've built a really tiny, intimate space. And also for us, I think because space in Santa Fe is such a challenge, it's really reinforcing to learn that you can create a theater in just an empty room.
When I left last night after watching this play, it was a very emotional experience, let's put it that way. For the two of you playing these roles, you have to embody these roles, and yet as human beings you have to somehow distance yourself from them. What's the emotional experience like of playing each of these roles, mother and daughter?
Well, it's extremely emotional. I mean, to the point where, since it is a play that is only about two people, there isn't time to reflect very much on what's going on. You are in the moment, as it were, and you have to be there emotionally constantly throughout the play. There's no moment of looking back and saying, you know, how did that scene go? Or
yeah, you're never off stage letting someone else. Right.
Yeah, so it's very intense for the actor, and I'm sure it is for Mona. She can speak for herself, but it is one is totally caught up in what one is doing throughout. The actor, it doesn't really appear, the objective observer appear that much. You're too engaged. And I don't know how, I think Mona might feel the same way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a full-out sprint. Emotionally, as an actor, it's a full-out sprint. And I've decided in this one especially to set up sort of guideposts for myself to make sure I don't bring it home. Because these are the kinds of characters that are easy to embody in the wrong places.
Right, right.
And so I have a very structured way to get home before I get home.
How do you do that?
I use a lot of music, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
You mean like in the car on the way home?
In the car on the way home.
What kind of music?
Oh, a really obnoxious bad dance music, and I blare it, and there's I use the...
Not 70s disco.
No, mm-mm. No, I use Red Hot Chili Peppers and Prince, and I just have this mix that works for me to pull me out and let me be home, because
right.
Yeah, this is definitely not somebody I want to bring home with me.
Is that an occupational hazard of acting, that you bring your characters home with you and
oh, totally.
Get boundary
yes.
confusion?
Oh, yes, I think so. I think... just working on this play, I mean, I find myself talking often as the character talks and reacting and saying things that the character does. It is difficult for me to disengage, but like Mona, I too play music, which I didn't know she did, but it was interesting to hear that. I do.
What's your choice?
Well, I play, you know, it depends, you know, it depends on what I have there. It can be jazz. I think jazz frees me a great deal. Or blues. Something that's relaxed and improv'd.
Right,
sometimes
right.
Classical music, whatever. But that you do have to disengage or try as much as you can to get away from it. Even if you don't totally.
right. Mm. Scott, now you are not acting for a change. Have you done a lot of directing before? Is this new for you?
Not a whole lot. I guess this is maybe the fourth play I've directed.
What's it like for you not to be on stage?
I love it. I mean, it's a great story. I'm working with great actors. I love it. It's interesting. Yeah, I think you learn about acting from directing, and you learn about directing from acting. So yeah, it's been really rewarding.
Tell us about the playwright Marcia Norman. The play, I guess she wrote this and won the Pulitzer Prize for it in 1983. So it's set about at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she won the Pulitzer Prize in '83, and the first production of it was at. The American Repertory Theater, where I went to grad school, actually. I remember there was a big poster of the production that was still up in the lobby there.
At Harvard and Cambridge,
yeah.
Mass.
And another play that she's written that's pretty well known is Getting Out. She teaches playwriting now in New York at Juilliard and NYU. And she's also started to do some more writing for things like Law and Order and shows like that. But I believe this was her big landmark play. Came out in 1983.
And the play is called Night Mother by Marcia Norman, and it opens this Thursday at El Museo Cultural. I am struck by how much intense mother-daughter intensity there is, but how little love there is, or how little the word love is actually used at all in this play. Did that, you're nodding, Lois, did that strike you also about the script?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the problems is the non-communication at times between the mother and daughter, and then there are times when I think it does come to the fore, and they do relate to each other, and they do communicate. But it's not a you know, touchy-feely relationship of affection and warmth between these two at all. And that's another thing that makes it extremely interesting to analyze and to portray.
How did you do the preparation to play the role?
Well, I have my own way of doing. I mean, I could just go over and over and over the script. I read it, you know, hundreds of times, and try to understand what the playwright is getting at with these characters and what she really means. So I think the playwright is extremely important, especially in a play like this where things are not obvious at first glance. You really have to analyze them and discover them by reading them over and over and over again. So that's pretty much my process of preparing. And then I become the characters. I start memorizing it, I suppose. It's very difficult to talk, you know, to articulate that.
Right, right. Now, the two of you, Mona and Lois, have worked together. What are some of the other things you've worked on? Did they have that similar bondedness?
No, actually, Lois and I have only done one play together, and it was The Number Giver. It was, I don't know, 7 years ago or something?
Perhaps. Uh-huh.
And it was not. We were strangers in the play. But, again, the play revolved around the two of us, so it was really a treat to be able to work again and to dive into this mother-daughter relationship and this very troubled mother-daughter relationship, where it's just this idea of how do you create connection on stage with two disconnected people has been a wonderful challenge and wonderful the journey to take.
Now, have you, Scott, made contact with people who work, for example, at suicide hotlines and people who are involved with the whole question of suicide, which, of course, is a big public issue, public problem?
We've definitely, we're definitely aware of the extreme sensitivity of the issue, and that it's a very real issue for a lot of people. Anyone who has questions about the content of the play or what's depicted, we're happy to answer those questions before they come see the play. We've just basically tried to, without giving away the ending, to, you know, to put it out there what the story's about. I haven't done a lot of talking to specific groups. I mean, I've done some research on the issue, and Mona's done a lot of it with her character work. But we're definitely not trying to hide anything if people want to know what it's about, if it's a sensitive issue for them.
So people can actually call in advance.
And find, yeah, if they want to know what's depicted, we're happy to tell them that. You know.
There's tickets are available in advance, and the number is 660-2379. And people can also talk to a real person at that time. Tell us more about Ironweed Productions.
Well, this is our third production. Our mission is to produce plays that reflect the diversity of the American experience, which is why we've shifted away from Shepherd. we're also really geared toward young people and young artists. And actually, with this production, we're having Institute of American Indian Arts young student playwright who's written a play, and a portion of our proceeds from the production is going to go toward supporting a production of her play at IAIA with directed by students and performed by students there. So we really try to nurture and support young artists with our projects as well.
Tell us a little bit about your own background as an actor and as a theater person.
I lived in D.C. for quite a while. I got involved with acting there, and went to graduate school, moved with my wife up to Boston to do graduate school at ART, and then moved to New York. And I guess about four years there, I pursued theater and did regional theater, and you know, and but I didn't really I wasn't really satisfied with getting hired for jobs, you know, just hustling for jobs that I wasn't even really interested in. And so when we were there, I I started getting more interested in getting groups of people together that I knew to read plays that I was really interested in, and started being more drawn to producing my own projects. And that for me has been the most satisfying thing, is bringing a group of people together to work on a story that you're all really committed to and interested in.
Have you tried your hand at playwriting?
No, I don't.
Is that in your plans?
No, I don't write plays well. I don't write plays well, but I definitely love, I love good writing.
Lois, tell us about your background.
In the theater?
Yes.
Oh, well, I too have come from the East Coast and done some work there and done some regional theater, and then came out here and got married and had children, and then I still kept up working in the theater as much as I could. And I too enjoy doing things that are either original or things that are kind of on the edge, rather than just things that are easy to do. I like challenges, and I think Scott has really presented one here. And I'm very grateful to him, and I'm also very grateful to be able to work with Mona again, because that's been a delight.
Mona, tell us about your background in theater.
I think I've been doing this since I was about 15, and I actually came from Chicago and finished up graduate degree, and I didn't feel prepared to hit New York or Chicago or L.A. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be somewhere where I felt like I could do interesting work and not have to hustle. I saw where people were going after graduate school and what they were doing, and I wasn't interested in that kind of theater. I wanted more community-based kind of thing. And so we ended up here in Santa Fe. And I do, you know, like maybe one show a year, because I have two small children, so... you know, I still keep my toe in there a little bit.
The play is Night Mother, and it opens this Thursday at 8 o'clock, and it runs Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 8, and then Sunday at 2 for the coming 3 weekends at El Museo Cultural. And the telephone number for tickets and for any more information that you want is 660-2379. This is an Ironweed Productions. And I want to thank you all for being here. Director Scott Harrison and actors Lois Viscoli and Mona Malik, thanks so much for coming this early to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having
us. Well, thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now to hear a commentary from Ron Blumberg. Stay tuned to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's Ron Blumberg, just the voice in the crowd. In case no one told you, the Major League Baseball season started last week. Now, traditionally, the president throws out the first ball on opening day. This year, for some reason, Bush didn't want to show his face. Strange, because I'm sure he would have received this kind of warm reception. But this week is a momentous one in baseball. On Sunday, every ballpark will honor the 60th anniversary of Jackie Robinson breaking the color line. 1947. Years before the Civil Rights Movement, he was his own Civil Rights Movement. The death threats, the abuse, and through it all, he played beautifully. Incredible determination and courage. One question this year is, will the Yankees win the World Series? They haven't won one in 7 years, or should I say, damn Yankees. There's a song from that Broadway musical that gets me going every morning, no matter how down and miserable I am. Check it out.
A great slugger we haven't got. A great pitcher we haven't got. A great ball club we haven't got. What do we got?
Oh, you're getting the idea.
We've got hope. We don't sit around and mope. Not a solitary sod do we heed. Mister, cause we've got hope.
Boys, I'm proud of you.
Thanks, Skip. Let's go get 'em. And I'll talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
KSFR's Ron Blumberg can be heard each Tuesday on the Radio Cafe, Thursdays after the news at noon, and each Saturday before the top of the 10 o'clock hour, right after Bob Edwards.
I'd like now to welcome Jill St. Thomas of the Step It Up campaign to tell us what is going on locally in the campaign to stop global warming. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here. Now, tell us about the Step It Up campaign, and we'll talk in a moment about the event that's happening this weekend.
Well, the Step It Up campaign, I found through the Al Gore website, actually, which took me to stopglobalwarming.com. And on there, Step It Up is a campaign that started out of Connecticut, and it's a grassroots effort to create citizen awareness and to create an incentive for Congress and legislators to actually do something about global warming. The Democrats took over, but nothing's really started to happen yet. And I think out of that frustration, this has come. And what we're doing with Step It Up is there will be, on April 14th, there will be over 1,500 rallies that will happen succinctly throughout the United States in 50 states. And
all on the same day?
All on the same day. And they will vary. In New York City, in Manhattan, they're going to do a body link with people. They're going to hold hands. And they're going to create what will be the new barrier, or what would be a barrier that's going to be the new tide line for Manhattan once global warming actually comes in the 40 feet that it's expected.
Good heavens.
So that should be incredibly interesting. I don't know how many people are involved with that. I think it's over 100,000, but that's quite an effort.
Hands across Manhattan,
exactly.
Basically.
Hands across Manhattan. And some of the other events are very simple. People are just, asking other people to come over for coffee. Or here in Santa Fe, I think there are 9 other rallies here in Santa Fe that are Step It Up rallies. And there are a group of people that are bicycling to the farmer's market. Together, there's a rally out in Madrid that's just a potluck that people are going to be talking about and sharing their views and their information about global warming. And then I was spurred as just a citizen basically trying to help save the world. And I teamed up with the Sierra Club. And with the Sierra Club, we have created an Earth Action Day rally that is going to happen at the Franklin Miles Park.
This coming Saturday.
This coming Saturday, April 14th, from 1 o'clock until 3 o'clock. And we are going to have many booths of green companies and green environmental groups. For example, PNM Blue Sky will be there, which is a wonderful program for buying into wind-generated power to offset your electric bill directly through PNM. I don't know if a lot of people are aware of that program, but it's wonderful.
Yeah, they put a little flyer in your electric bill, and if you sign up for it, then some percentage of your power will come from wind rather than from fossil fuels. And it costs a little more, but not a whole lot more.
It's a little more, yeah. I think it comes out to about $20-some-odd dollars per block of kilowatt that you buy. And that's about what the average person uses, is one of these kilowatt blocks. So it's a little more, but it certainly makes you feel better if you leave a light on all night long or, something like that. Who else will be there? The City Waste Management Group is going to be there to basically discuss recycling. I'm confused about how to recycle here in Santa Fe. So they have a pretty low profile, and we invited them to come. The Forestry Seedling Program is going to be there to inform people how they can buy trees from the Forestry Division that are indigenous, easy to grow here. They're tiny little seedlings, bare roots, and incredibly inexpensive. Pennies for these trees. Who else are we going to have? Beaver Toyota is going to be there with all 3 of their hybrids. We're also going to have a veggie car there as well.
A veggie car means a car that runs on basically cooking oil, which is the equivalent of biodiesel.
That's right. And it's painted with flowers. And that will be there with Positive Solar, Positive Energy, which is a solar company. They'll be there as well. Santa Fe Hemp will be there. Interfaith Alliance will be there as well.
So this is really a chance for people to talk one-on-one to all of these groups and sort of see where they fit in. I mean, I think part of the problem that people have with global warming is everybody wants a solution. A lot of people don't know what their part is.
Exactly. And one program that's going to happen, the Sierra Club and the City of Santa Fe and PNM have coupled together. And they're doing what's called the Aladdin Project, which is anyone can bring an incandescent light bulb to trade in for a compact fluorescent.
And you can bring as many as you want?
You can bring as many as you want. And for every 5 that you bring, you get a free pass to the Chavez Center. And
so save energy and get fit.
Exactly. And these compact fluorescents will have, you know, an estimated life of 10 years, and they will reduce your energy bill. They burn a lot cooler. And this is the City of Santa Fe, PNM, and the Sierra Club. And
they'll give you back a 100-watt equivalent bulb.
Absolutely. For free, yes.
For free.
It's just a trade.
That's very interesting. I have read that the compact fluorescent bulbs, for all of their energy-saving qualities, also have a problem, which is that they contain mercury. So a flood of those into the landfills is not going to be exactly good for the environment.
It's not. And it's an issue. I've certainly spoken to the City Waste Management Department about that. And the Sierra Club. And the issue is that the compact fluorescents do indeed contain mercury. They contain about as much mercury as a watch battery, which is not a great deal, but it still is mercury. And at this point, the Santa Fe Waste Management Division does not have a proper way to dispose of all of these. And they only have... right now, they only have a hazardous waste, a household hazardous waste day once a year.
I know.
Which is April 22nd, I think it is this year. 20th or 22nd. It's the following Saturday from our rally. And, of course, you can dispose of all of your compact fluorescents that way. But they truly do need to up their system. They need to... deal with this on a serious level, because as we know, Walmart, Target, Costco, all of these large companies are selling compact fluorescents by the box loads. So it's going to be an issue. The good thing about it is that these light bulbs last 10 years. So, with a little bit of hope and some funding and some stimulation, hopefully Santa Fe can actually be prepared.
So we've got a 9 or 10 year window to figure out how to do this before
exactly.
The first bulbs start actually burning out.
Exactly, yeah, which is something to take into consideration for sure. And, there are some crazy things are happening all over the world. Not crazy, crazy in the sense that it's wonderful. Australia, I heard, has completely banned incandescent light bulbs. Totally. You can only use compact fluorescents there. So,
they have the incandescent police come in and see see if you have any old ones in your
unscrew your bulbs while you're out.
Right.
Well, the positive thing about that is when this type of thing happens, it's only going to stimulate the technology that it's going to take to to dispose of these light bulbs properly or to recycle them, which optimally would be the best thing.
And to eventually create non-toxic light bulbs in the first place.
Exactly. It's going to stimulate those companies to do that.
We're talking to Jill St. Thomas of the Step It Up campaign.
Yes.
So what else is happening? This is all this Saturday, the 14th of April, from 1 to 3 at Franklin Miles Park, which is on the corner of Seringo and Camino Carlos Rey.
That's right.
That's a nice big park.
It's a giant park. It's beautiful. There's plenty of parking. It's easy to get to. And we're going to be setting up at the basketball courts right there, and we have Peter Wirth will be speaking, a representative, and also Chris Calvert of the city will be speaking as well. And we're hoping the mayor is going to be there as well, and Mayor Koss, and we're trying for some other people, but I'm not going to say their name until they say they're coming.
All right, then.
We also have some local bands that will be there. Round Mountain, which is a fabulous local band, World Music, will be there. And Peter Angel's Blues Band will be there as well. And we will have lots of activities. There will be a costume contest for any child or adult that wishes to dress as their favorite animal or ecosystem that they would miss the most. when and if global warming takes its turn and really starts hitting.
Dressing as an ecosystem, children of the world.
Yes, yes.
Think about it now. Do it on Saturday.
Exactly. It's a wonderful moment. What I'm going to do, my focus, is to, of course, take photographs and document the event and with banners and a couple of signs, and then we're going to submit these to the Associated Press, and hopefully the week following the rally, Step It Up, with its hundreds of thousands of people that will be doing this campaign, will have some type of impact on Congress. That's what we're hoping for. We want them to make legislation to help reduce emissions, carbon emissions, by 80% by 2050.
Now, this is that's a big number, and it's a number that is that has been 70 to 80% has been cited actually as necessary even sooner than that if we are to reverse the most damaging trends of global warming. But when we hear actual policy, there are numbers thrown around like 10%, 15%, maybe 20%.
I know, and so I think that although we know that we need to do more than that, I think that this was a very good number to stimulate Congress, because the 10 and 20% figures, that's not going to do it, especially with all of the coal plants that are being planned due to the federal administration that we have right now. I mean, there are something like 300 coal plants that they're actually considering installing clean coal. So those numbers are ridiculous. It's really just to pacify the public. And we need to do more. We need to ask for more. We need to demand more as a public. We need to do that.
Jill St. Thomas, I want to thank you so much for being with us here. This is the Step It Up campaign, and the local manifestation is this Saturday, the 14th of April, at Franklin Miles Park from 1 to 3 in the afternoon. Thank you so much for coming and telling us about it.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking to Dominique Mazzeau. Stay tuned to KSFR.
You're invited to join Forest Guardian's Stream Team and be part of the amazing transformation of the Santa Fe River. Plant native trees with friends and family and have fun in the sun on Forest Guardian's Santa Fe River Preserve, Saturday, April 14th, 10 a.m. till 3 p.m. Lunch, snacks, water, and tools provided. For details or to RSVP, visit fguardians.org or call 988-9126. Forest Guardians is a tax-exempt organization.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by Garcia Street Books, also a supporter of the Santa Fe Poet Laureate Program. Here's a poem by Laureate Arthur Z.
The Owl. The path was purple in the dusk. I saw an owl perched on a branch. And when the owl stirred, a fine dust fell from its wings. I was silent then and felt the owl quaver. And at dawn, waking, the path was green in the May light.
You're listening to KSFR, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I would like to now welcome Dominique Mazzeau. She is here to tell us about Mayor Koss's Generosity Sunday here in Santa Fe and the Network of Spiritual Progressives. Welcome, Dominique.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having me here this morning.
It's great to have you. Now, this is a Generosity Sunday. What's up with that? What's going on?
Well, as you said, it's organized by the Network of Spiritual Progressives, which is a national organization with 112 chapters. They increase by the week, practically. We are the Northern New Mexico chapter. There is one in Albuquerque in New Mexico and other people in other parts of the state. The vision of the National Spiritual Progressives is that, well, it's threefold, the work of this organization is to change the bottom line to a bottom line of love, compassion, caring, generosity, and environmental sensitivity, and so forth.
You mean from the bottom line of profit?
Greed and power. I mean, we have nothing against profit, but it has to be balanced with these other more spiritual elements. And
Well, there's an event happening. I mean, the event is this Sunday. So in case you haven't had enough with the Step It Up rally on Saturday. On Sunday from 1 to 5, there's actually an event happening right here in Santa Fe.
Yeah, it's a National Day of Action, which is sponsored by our organization to promote a new way of achieving security for the United States and the entire world. In a way, today, despite the good intentions of most Americans, our international policies are widely perceived to be based on military and economic domination of the world. So our desire for security seems to override our ability to empathize with other cultures. And as a result, we face increasing enmity, global instability, and insecurity. So the idea to cause a global security is to do this program called Global Marshall Plan. You are not old enough to remember the Marshall Plan that was an idea put out by the United States to help Europe rebuild after the World War II. And this is an idea based on that, and this is why we call it the Global Marshall Plan. And it would mean a certain percentage, maybe 5% of the global the GNP, to help other countries, you know, with their health, education, all
genuine infrastructure things, as opposed to military domination.
Military
or economic
domination. So this is a very big idea, of course, but without dreams, we don't move forward. And so we chose this day, and we chose the form of a festival to put out this idea. And there are about 80 groups out of the 112 chapters in the country that are doing events of different kinds, you know, letter writing campaigns. We chose a festival because, being in Santa Fe, we like to include the arts with these more political programs.
Now, you also chose the day right before income tax filing day. That was significant, I take it?
Yes. We feel that it's another way to kind of change the emphasis from, you know, the dominant way of doing things to a more generous way, and to look at these issues from this new paradigm we want to put out.
Now, you have been involved with peace work as an artist and as an activist for many years. I've known you for almost two decades.
Yes.
How did all this work evolve inside of you?
Oh, for me, well, first of all, I've been on a spiritual path for a long time. And, you know, spirits, there are many, many ways of explaining, but it's really about union or reunion. So it would make sense that spirit and art would be one, first of all. And so that led me to exploring what is the spiritual in art in our time. And then later on, it really led me to spiritual and politics, because I feel, again, politics, you know, things are not as separate as our culture makes us think they are. So it's been on both levels a progression. So now more and more I'm bringing art, spirit, and more political. But for me, it's not political. It's more bringing the values into the civic dialogue. For example, this summer I did a project on forgiveness, which was a theme that I first explored 20 years ago when I was, I started working as an artist after supporting artists in different ways for many years. So now this time, for this particular Generosity Sunday, I'm creating a street character who is a priestess of generosity. So I will be, it's a way to interact with people, because often in events of different kinds, actually, people feel very separated and not involved. So I think an art that's process-oriented and participatory is what really the culture is needing at this point, for people to feel they are involved and engaged, and the interaction may set them off in getting more involved, perhaps, or opening a little, you know, thing in their mind, and maybe they will decide to get involved, or or be touched in some way, you know.
You used to be a big New York art gallery dealer, wheeler dealer, is that right?
Well, I never used that word, but I was director of a gallery in New York in, you know, until 85.
And what happened? I always wondered whether you had sort of a sudden spiritual conversion or something like that.
Well, you know, when you ask certain questions about life and you keep asking them, eventually you get answers. And in 79, I got very powerful answers when I spent time in a spiritual community in Finhorn, at Finhorn in Scotland.
Where they used to grow those giant vegetables?
Yeah, cabbage and such. So after that, I knew with every cell of my being that my path was to find the spiritual in art, in our time, because each period has a way to express that. And so I went on this quest, which really changed my life. And it was not only my work, but also my personal life. I mean, everything is affected when you are, you know, directed to change your path.
Now, when you say you're going on this quest to find the spiritual in art, when you look back on the art that you had been working with and dealing, how did you see it? Did you see it differently? I mean, did you feel that there was some spiritual value in it?
Well, there was, but, you know, there was. And every period, as I said, has a way to express spirit. But I, you know, in 79, there were not many people who were speaking about the spiritual and art, and actually a breaking point was 86 when the Los Angeles County Museum organized a big exhibition called The Spiritual in Art, which was covering the art of the early 20th century, Mondrian, Kandinsky, and people who were working from the abstract, you know, point of view. And that was the first time, in a way, that the word spiritual and art were put together in such a very big way. And, of course, you know, 20-some years later, those two words are much, you know, brought together more.
We're talking to Dominique Mazot. So how did you end up in Santa Fe?
Oh, after 20 years in New York, I knew it was time to move on, and two friends who knew me independently of each other said, "Oh, Dominique, I think Santa Fe would be a good place for you." So I bought a ticket one day and came and loved it at first sight and moved. And that was 20 years ago.
So what, when you look back on your 20 years of being a creator and doing this kind of activism, what do you think have been the most really effective projects in terms of not only feeding yourself, but touching other people?
Well, I started, you know, with the great cleansing of the Rio Grande, which was an idea that, you know, for me, it's my heart is directing my art, and that's why I call myself a artist, you know, because truly that's what makes me do things as an artist. And so I did this project for 7 years, the great cleansing of the Rio Grande, where I went to the river every month to do a cleansing ritual, and did that, you know, without...
Cleansing ritual meaning picking up the trash?
On the physical level, that was what it was. And, you know, when you work on the spiritual level, there are many other levels of listening to the river, learning and communicating and so forth. And that was the first one, which I did, you know, kind of following my heart, not trying to prove anything but it was very powerful, and to this day I get, you know, people, because I'm in the history books, not all, but quite a few, of art and feminism and so forth, and people contact me about it. So, you know, I think there is, and when you look at what's happening in art, there are more and more artists who are called to do things not for art for art's sake, but art for earth's sake or life's sake, as, you know, it can be put.
And so staying with this cleansing of the river, do you think it made a difference?
At the time it did, you know, and a lot of people thought it did. It was kind of a consciousness, you know, raising project in a way, which this Generosity Sunday is. And, you know, these things take a long, long time. To change consciousness, it takes a long time, whether you do it through activism or art and activism and or spiritual art, whatever you call it. It takes a long time.
Well, the one place to go if you're interested in this, ladies and gentlemen, is this Sunday from 1 to 7, the Network of Spiritual Progressives and the City of Santa Fe Teen Night Program in conjunction with Warehouse 21 Generosity Sunday in DeVargas Park across from the Guadalupe Church right here in downtown Santa Fe with Dominique Mazo as the Priestess of Generosity and many other people and events down there. Dominique, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And I also want to say that some generous person fixed my license plate a couple of weeks ago, which was hanging by one screw. So they came to the Santa Fe Bacon Company and somehow put a screw in and fixed it. Whoever you are, please present yourself and let me know who you are, and thank you very much.
People love you.
Yeah, they fixed my license plate. I've been trying to fix
great.
It for years, unsuccessfully. All right, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, and this program can be heard at any time of day now, start at the santafe.radiocafe.org website, thanks to .foil Computer Services of Santa Fe on the web at .foil.com. That's .foil.com. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, the Jazz Hoedown. We will see you tomorrow. Have a wonderful day. Ciao.